Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the first show of Angel Insights in 2022. It's the show that takes you deep into early stage investing by interviewing the top angel investors, early stage VCs, as well as the companies they invest in. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Axis Venture Fund. Today's episode is going to be a doozy. We decided to start the year with a very special episode with none other than Nick Jenkins. Now, before starring on BBC's Dragon's Den, being an angel investor, Nick was actually the founder of Moonpig.com, or shall I say Moonpig.com. Prior to founding Moonpig, he completed an MBA and was a commodity trader at Glencore in Russia, having studied Russian literature at university. Nick brings a wealth of experience to the show and some fantastic insights. Nick, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, me too.
So I did some digging before this episode into your background, and I found it quite unique, and I wanted to highlight a few things that kind of stood out. You studied Russian literature. What was your thinking in going into that when it was not a very popular topic at the time?
It wasn't very popular at the time, but which meant it was a very easy course to get onto at university. I think otherwise I might have done law. But I also figured if I was going to learn a language, I might as well learn a language of a country where they didn't really speak English. Certainly at the time, and this was way back in 1987 to 1990, the Russians and the Soviet Union didn't learn English because there was no point because they weren't allowed out. What it meant was that you could learn Russian reasonably well, and that was the only language that you had to speak to Russians with because they couldn't speak back in English. Whereas if you learn French, you better be really, really good at French to be able to use it in business because the French are really good at English.
I'm not good at French or English, to be honest. Having grown up in the States, I say a few things funny. But with the Russian literature, was your idea to go into business in Russia? Because, I mean, obviously you then went on to do commodity trading at Glencore. Was your thought, I'm going to learn Russian, I'm going to understand it, and then I'm going to go and find work with Russia? Or were you just thinking, it's an interesting language, I want to learn it?
Well, actually, I was sponsored through university by the army, and my original idea was to use Russian in the army, but that idea fell apart when the Berlin Wall collapsed. So, and in fact, of course, the prospect of using it in business was pretty slim, because when I first started working in Russia, the only people you were allowed to speak to did speak English, but that's because they worked for the KGB. So it only became useful as a business language after I'd finished the degree.
And when you did finish the degree, Berlin Wall had fallen.
The Soviet Union collapsed. The year that I arrived there, the Soviet Union collapsed in front of me. And then it became very important to be able to speak Russian.
And did Glencore come calling for you? Was it something that they were actively hiring Russian speakers, or was it something that you kind of sought out?
Yes, I think I'd got a job out there already. I was I set up a sales office for a forklift truck company, a German company.
Oh.
And at the time, the Glencore, or Mark Rich, as it was known then, was looking for Russian speakers because they figured it was considerably easier to teach a Russian speaker how to trade commodities than it was to teach a commodity trader how to speak Russian.
Wow. And I can already see the start of entrepreneurship in you. You know, you went out there and you set up your own business. Then you got poached, if you will, and you spent some time doing sugar trading. And eventually you decided to kind of pull out from that.
Yeah, I'd done 8 years there, 8 or 9 years. And it was exciting. But at the same time, it also had a few hairy moments. And I had a death threat nailed to my front door.
Oh.
And among other things. And I just decided it was time to come home.
That would probably send me home as well, or further than home. But So talk me through this then. You've come back to the UK. At that time, did you have some fresh ideas for starting a business, or was it something like you didn't necessarily know what you wanted to do?
I didn't have any ideas at the time. The reason I did the MBA was it was a good opportunity to spend a few months brushing up my business skills and using it as a sounding board for different business ideas that I might come across. And it worked very well for that. I had about 4 or 5 different business ideas. And the idea that came out of that in the end was the one for Moonpig.
I mean, Moonpig was obviously a super successful company, but at the start of it, what was your thought process of taking on the high street? Because effectively, Moonpig was doing that. You were trying to produce these personalized goods to, as you've phrased it before, create an end to the British high street.
Well, I wouldn't go as far. I never thought I'd put an end to the British high street, but I did realize that the internet was going to become much more important. And if you wanted to sell something on the internet, if you sell a physical good like a camera, then someone would write an algorithm that would compare the price of your camera with the price of anyone else selling the same camera. So in order to differentiate from the high street, I wanted to produce something that was personalized and would be difficult to sell in the high street. And in the end, what we were able to do was to produce something which was very difficult for anyone else to replicate online or offline, because we had exclusive rights to designs and had a lot of original content. And that was a great way of preserving margin, because if you sell a digital camera, your margins will ultimately be squeezed by a pricing algorithm that will force everybody to buy the cheapest version until eventually gets to the point where whoever ends up selling them makes a barely acceptable level of profitability.
Obviously, early on, you had this idea and you encountered these scaling issues, as all startups do. And I think what I read was that, you know, the acquisition or finding a sustainable acquisition channel for Moonpig was kind of the most difficult challenge. What did you all eventually do to overcome that challenge?
Well, two things happened. One was that I was very good at analyzing the numbers. When you don't have very much money, you have to get very good at analyzing the numbers. And I realized that we had an incredible repeat rate. We didn't have very many customers, but the customers that we did have were repeating and sticking with us and were very, very loyal. And it's a lesson that I've learned in particular in the last year in online retail, when the cost of customer acquisition has really risen, is that the real power is in a business that has a great repeat rate. That was the thing that kept me going. And I had a point in 2004 when a lot of my investors said, this is never going to work. It will never make a profit. Don't put any more money into it of your own. And we're certainly not putting any more money into it. And the only reason that I continued and put more money of my own into it was because I could see in the numbers that the repeat rate was there. And in fact, we had 2 years where we spent nothing on marketing and our sales grew by 30% a year.
Wow.
On the basis of viral marketing alone. You know, I send you a card, you like it, you look at the back, it says moonpig.com, you go and buy a card. I didn't have much experience at the time, but now I look at that and think that's incredible that you have a business that actually grows 30% in a year with no marketing spend whatsoever. When I look at businesses now that I've invested in and I get to that, I think, is this like a Moonpig 2004 moment? When in fact I can see the truth in the numbers, but everyone else has missed that. Or in fact, is it destined to failure? I've had that a few times where I've had to make that decision of is this something which is going to right itself, or should I just stop throwing good money after bad?
I think there's many names being given to that phenomenon, but product market fit is probably the one that sticks the most, where the customers are doing the selling for you. And you definitely hit that with that repeat rate and people talking about, oh, this is a great card. Oh, yeah. On the back, it's moonpig.com. So we're obviously glad that you stuck with it, because I'm a huge fan of the brand. I know it's, you know, you exited it in 2011. We'll talk about that. And it's gone on to, I think since then it's been acquired, if I'm not mistaken, by another group. Or
we sold most of it in 2011, and then I sold the rest of it in 2016 when it was sold to Exponent. Since then, it actually demerged from PhotoBox, and then the business that floated on the stock market is essentially the business that I sold, which is moonpig.com.
Fascinating. And let's go back to that exit for a second. So you'd been working on the business for quite a while, and 2011 comes around. Were you actively looking to exit the business, or was it just a case of being approached by them and an offer you couldn't refuse?
No, I'd started in about 2009 on an exit process, but it was a slow process of speaking to all the people who were potentially interested and flirting with them and rounding everybody up. In the end, we spoke to about 26 prospective buyers of the business in 2011 in a fairly carefully managed process.
That was incredible. And I suppose, and we'll come to it a little bit more later, but when you look at a company that you're going to invest in, are you already thinking about how they might exit before you put money into it?
I generally try to think about how they can make money, or I generally think about how they can make underlying profitability at the very least. And I'm quite old fashioned in that respect. Ultimately, at the end of that chain, somebody needs to take a profit out of the business for it to be worth something. And most people are focused on what the next person will pay for it. But I'm always focused on, when is that business eventually going to be throwing off cash? Because Moonpig, from 2008, Moonpig was throwing off £10 million in dividends every year until we sold it.
And I guess that year, 2008, is quite important as well, because that's when you decided to get into angel investing. So the company was doing well, Moonpig was doing well, it was throwing off dividends, and here you are with a bit of a windfall, and you think, what shall I do with it? No fancy cars, no, I'm going to put money into risky startups.
I think my share of the dividend that year was about £3.5 million, and that was, I think my outgoings were probably a couple 150,000 quid or something. So suddenly I found myself in a position, particularly with EIS investing, where you think, well, I've got a lot of income, I might as well offset it against something. And also by that point, I'd freed myself up a little bit. I've got a very good management team that were doing most of the day-to-day business. It was the right time to start getting involved in other businesses.
So we've transitioned to talking about angel investing. Fantastic. Let's start with an easy one. What is it that you look for in a company before you make an investment? You know, do you have a checklist? Do you have a set of rules or steps that you go through before making a decision?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, I look at the management team, because for every good idea, like a Google, there'll be another 1,000 Googles, and the difference is which team is going to win. And so I look for a really driven team who've got skin in the game, who've got good, strong commercial instincts and good values, but also someone I quite like to work with. I'm not interested in spending time with people that I just don't enjoy working with. That's quite important. On the product side, I need evidence that the customers like the product, that they're happy with the price, and that they've demonstrated, most importantly, that they've got some evidence that people are going to come back and buy it again at that price. And then beyond that, third point would be, is the addressable market big enough? And is the idea easily scaled? And the fourth point is, are the gross margins good? Is the underlying profitability of the business good? Those are the four things that I look for in any business.
Winding that back though, I mean, looking for evidence that the customers like the product, would that mean that you kind of focus on not true seed companies? So not companies that are just an idea and getting started. Do you have to have sales coming in, or is evidence of that the customers like the product some other form of demand?
Well, the thing is that I have invested in seed companies where we haven't proven whether or not they're prepared to pay the price or whether they're prepared to come back. And that has been painful. So I'd prefer to be investing at a slightly later stage where there's some evidence that they've proven the point that people like the product and are happy to pay the price. Takes a lot of the guesswork out of it.
Okay. And you said you had a few painful experiences investing earlier on. Are there any other kind of red flags or things that put you off investing in a company that, you know, on the surface looks brilliant, but something when you dig underneath just goes, nope, not for me?
Yes. I mean, in entrepreneurs, if I invest in somebody, I expect them to be 100% dedicated to that idea. I'm not interested in investing in somebody who's got two or three ideas, because what will happen is that when my idea that I put £1 million in gets difficult, they'll just swan off and go and focus on the other two that are looking easier at the time. So I want a complete focus on the business at hand.
Okay. Sticking with that theme a little bit, you've been investing for a little while now, and I know you've got some rules that you invest by, and I was wondering if you could maybe share some of those rules with us.
Yeah, I've learned a lot of painful lessons over time. One is I try very hard not to invest in friends' businesses. For one thing, it clouds your judgment. Two, you go in to help them, but when things go wrong, you end up being the one that has to shut their business down, and they will only remember that. And that gets very, very difficult. That's happened to me a couple of times. And it's easier to separate the two things. It doesn't mean to say that you can't end up becoming very friendly with the people that you invest in and enjoy working with them. It's just that if your motivation starts from the fact that you went to school with them and you're great old buddies, there is a lot of potential to fall out. And a lot of that comes from the fact that when businesses go wrong, as they often do, the founder will often not be willing to listen to the argument that actually it should just be shut down. Following on from that, I learned another lesson, which is I don't want to be more than 20% of the money going in. Because if I invest in a business and I'm the only financial investor that's come in, if you have another round, another investment round, and I have to follow on pro rata, if I don't follow on pro rata, it kills it. So you always have to think a little bit further ahead. By doing this, am I effectively locking myself into having to follow on in the next few rounds, because it would be so noticeable if I didn't.
Which comes on to the next point, which is about investing through a syndicate or creating a syndicate for the investment. Do you have a go-to syndicate? Is there a group of people that you consistently invest with?
I have invested through Ajuvo, which is a great syndicate of angel investors and really high-flying angel investors who really know their stuff. It's a very good group of people. Investing in a syndicate makes a lot of sense because it means that, for one, you've got the scrutiny of more people looking at it. And very often there'll be somebody within the syndicate that's got more expertise on that particular area. And the second thing is, comes back to my first point about not being more than 20% of the money. When you invest as a syndicate, if you decide not to follow on in that syndicate in the next round, it's not the end of the world for the company, and the company isn't going to go under because you said no, as long as the other four think that it's worthwhile investing in. Say there are five in a syndicate that invest in it. If all five people invested in it and decided not to follow on, then really that's telling you something, that really the business is not investable. But, you know, because occasionally there are times when I just don't want to follow on because I've lost interest in the sector or I've lost interest in the founder, but not that it's not worth investing following on. I just don't want to be forced to follow on. I like every decision about following on to be taken in its own merits.
Yeah, you don't want to have any bias or pressure, if you will, to follow on because you have to.
No, that's right. And if you're seen as the cornerstone investor, everybody's looking to you as the biggest investor. And then they'll think, oh, well, Nick's done some research on this. So if he follows on, I'll follow on. And then that's dangerous because you end up with a whole crowd of sheep all saying, meh, I'll follow on if you follow on. And no one's actually done any research on it.
And you definitely have confirmation bias there where, oh, he's done it, so it must be a good idea, so I'm in. And then you're sitting there going, oh, they're coming in as well. That's great. I've made a good decision.
Exactly. I mean, the clever founder is sitting in the middle, juggling the news around, telling the first investor that the second investor has already invested, on the basis of which the first investor then invests, but the second, and so on. Yeah. I think the really important thing is understanding why you're investing. And I invest for a variety of reasons. Sometimes I invest because I come across someone who I think is a great entrepreneur and I want to support them. I hope to make my money out of it. But I look at it a little bit like gambling in that it's an informed form of gambling. And you're pitting your knowledge and experience against the market. But sometimes I do things because I find them interesting. And it's not a huge amount of money. And if it goes wrong, it's not the end of the world. But it's an interesting subject matter that I don't know much about. And then there are other times when I'm investing because I think that this is a good money-making scheme. And those two things are quite separate. You need to separate them in your own mind about why you're investing. There are lots of reasons why people invest. Sometimes it's more like a hobby. They think this is an interesting area. I like the arts. So I'm investing in the arts. Yes, I'd like to get my money back. I'd like to be proved right. But sometimes it's more for fun. And as long as you're clear with yourself about those the reasons why you're investing, I think that's fine. It's when sometimes people sort of get confused about their motives.
You said something quite interesting there because you used the term putting your knowledge and skills against the market or betting against the market. Would that suggest that you like to be actively involved in many of your investments or at least some of them?
I think my point was that when you're making the selection, when you're doing your due diligence, I'm assessing a situation, looking at a business and assessing its commercial potential and also assessing the potential of the team to be able to make this happen. That's just like someone who knows the form of horses deciding whether he thinks going to win the race. He's not actually going to be running the race. You know, it is a question of pitting your analysis against market. And that's the reason why I think a lot of people do it. But, you know, sometimes it's because I have supportive investors in my business and I like to be supportive to other people starting out. But ultimately, I would like to get my money back plus some. And I suppose the game of it is that you would like to believe that by putting time and effort into managing your money, in the end, deliver a better return than you could do if you just simply passively left it with your portfolio manager.
Quite interesting. To that point, and don't mean to harp too much though, but do you ever take an active role in the companies that you're investing in, or are you generally more passive?
I do. I tend to get involved at the point of investing. I will work out where I think if I can add any value. I don't want to be involved in the day-to-day running of the business at all, but if I can point them in the right direction, give them the benefit of some of the expensive mistakes I've made, then I will. And I'll do that as long as I feel it's being valued and I'm being listened to. I try not to sit on the boards of companies unless I have a particularly large stake. And my rationale behind that is that if the company wants to listen to what you have to say, then it doesn't really matter if you're a director or not. And if they don't want to listen to what you have to say, then it doesn't really matter if you're a director or not. The real power in a company comes from shareholding, or it either comes from your natural authority, the fact that people listen to you and think that you've got something useful to say, or it comes from the fact that you own a sizable chunk of the shares. But it doesn't come from sitting on the board. But what does come from sitting on the board, and this is a big mistake that I've made in the past, is that if you are the only grown-up sitting on the board when things go wrong, you end up holding the baby. And you end up sitting on the inside apologizing out to shareholders when, in fact, it's considerably easier just to be an aggrieved shareholder. So you've got to really think hard about whether you want to join the board, because you do end up taking a lot of responsibility for things that are beyond your control to some extent.
I think that's a great point for any investors out there who haven't yet stepped up to a board position and are considering it. You know, I know our board, being in a financial company, our board and chair actually take on regulatory responsibility. Yeah, they have oversight and they have to be registered with the FTSE and such, which is putting their head at risk a bit more than the shareholders.
Yeah.
It's a big step, and you shouldn't just jump at the chance because it sounds pretty to be a non-exec and looks good on a CV. There's a lot of responsibility that comes with it.
There is. And if you don't control the vote, then you find yourself being dragged along. I'm quite a stickler for making sure that companies don't go into administration and pay their bills. And founders will naturally drive the thing into the wall, and they won't pick up on it unless they're absolutely forced to, until all the money has gone and the lights have gone out. And in truth, if you're a responsible director, you need to be looking at how much cash you need to have in the bank before you take a sensible decision about whether or not the business can continue. If you don't have the weight of votes to force that through, you can be a lone voice in all of that. So I'm very wary about joining the board. I am, if I'm investing, I like to give companies good advice about how to set themselves up legally so that they've got a set of articles which are fair to both minority investors and also allow the founders to get on with running the business. But one of those things basically always says that if any shareholder or group of shareholders owning, say, 20% or 15% or more of the shares, they have the right to appoint an observer or a director. By and large, being an observer is actually much better because you still get all the access to the information as to what's going on in the company, but you don't have the legal responsibility that goes with dealing with what goes wrong.
It's an interesting point because I think with businesses nowadays, there's been a huge push about transparency. And I'm wondering what the role of an observer actually is versus being a well-informed shareholder. We like to keep our shareholders abreast of everything that's going on. And I would say if someone joined as an observer and sat in, they'd probably learn just a little bit more than what we share out to shareholders, which I think is a good way of doing things. And obviously, you can disagree with that. But have you seen this change in the companies that you've been involved with recently? Have they become more transparent about what's going on, or less, or about the same?
It varies. It varies a lot. I mean, I have some companies that just send out almost no shareholder information whatsoever. And of course, you know, they're not obliged to. A lot of it depends on what's in the articles. And there's a point at which also you want to be careful about how much information you're making public, or at least spreading, broadcasting to a wider audience. And if you've got 20 or 30 different shareholders, and then you might have some disgruntled ex-founders in amongst that, and you might have all sorts of different people, you do have to be careful about how you share market-sensitive information.
Very true. I'm wondering if there are any other trends, though, that you've seen either rise or fall in the time that you've been angel investing. I mean, you've been doing it for a little more than a decade, so.
Yes. One of the trends that I've seen, which is very interesting, is the trend in reverse vesting of founder shares, which, well, the first time I came across it was about halfway through my angel investing career. And someone suggested, and I thought that was outrageously unfair for the founders. And then I thought about it and realized in this particular company, there were four founders and an incoming shareholder saying that you need a shareholders agreement to bind you. That if one of you leaves, that those shares have to be distributed amongst to the company. As it transpired, about a month after that was agreed, we found out that one of their founders had really been working on a side hustle and hadn't really been doing any work for the last 3 months, and he was sacked, and his shares were distributed amongst the other three. But it can often happen that those sort of agreements protect a group of founders from each other, which is quite important. But it has also led to a cult of co-founder status. Lots and lots of people seem to be quite concerned about having co-founder status, even though they might well have joined the company a year or two after it actually started. And it's fair to say, of course, that Elon Musk didn't start Tesla, and there are various examples of that, but he is largely responsible for where it is today. And so it is important, if you want to give people co-founder status, the idea that you can give them some proper equity fairly early on, but also be able to take it off them if they leave. It's helpful because if someone comes along and they want you to invest £1 million for a 20% stake in their business, and you put £1 million in, then the next day they say, well, actually, I'm off because I've been offered a nice job elsewhere, and I look forward to seeing how my 80% of the company goes. You're sort of obliged to have to hire someone to come in and take over the company and try to run it. And the only way that you can get out of that situation normally would be to effectively, well, actually, you know, it's very difficult because you wouldn't even have a voting majority at the company. Having those sort of arrangements are quite helpful.
No, I would agree with you. And there's a lot of discussion on how many founders is the right number. And obviously, there's no right answer, but most people seem to say two, maybe three. Any more than that, too many chefs in the kitchen. I don't know if you've stuck by that as well.
Well, when I set up Moonpig, I wanted to be the only founder in it, partly because, of course, if you've got two founders, then on day one, you've given away half your company. And there'll always be one person who's got a slightly stronger drive than the other. So the chance of the pair of you or three of you agreeing 5 years down the road that you've all made an equal contribution to the business is pretty rare. And it has worked in some companies. Innocent Drinks worked very well. The founders of Innocent Drinks would all argue that actually it wouldn't have carried on had they all not been involved. I figured it was considerably easier to start on my own, and then I brought in investors whose contribution really came as a basis of the money that they put in rather than them being there. But what it also means is that you have the clarity of vision of one person, which rather than a sort of Frankenstein lowest common denominator strategy, which is that you only ever go forward with the things that you all happen to agree on.
Some good insight. We've covered a bit about what you look for in a company, how you approach things, and your rules around investing. So let's take a look at a few examples from your portfolio and talk about kind of what you were thinking and what went on, and maybe if you'd have approached some things differently. So the first one I wanted to talk about was Gentrack, which is, you know, a phenomenal case where you invested about £800,000 into it. It IPO'd 18 months later. You made a sizable profit from that. But had you held on post-IPO, it would have gone up. And had you held on even longer afterwards, it would have come back down. Talk us through your thinking on that one. How do you find an opportunity like that where it returns so quickly?
Well, of course, there is a massive element of luck in all of this stuff. That was one of my first investments, third or fourth investment that I've made. And the founder of it, well, he wasn't really the founder, actually. He was someone who came into it later, but drove it forward. And he was the chairman as a chap I was at university with. And I know him very well, and I know he's extremely good. And he's very, very conservative and doesn't put a large amount of money in things unless he's absolutely certain. And he's very capable. And so it looked like a good one to back. But I'd got a lot of money sitting around in dividends. And I thought, yeah, hey, fantastic. And by sheer luck, it floated very, very quickly. And I think I made about five times on that. Yeah, if I'd stayed in longer, I watched it go from £2 a share to about £6 a share and then came back right back down again to about 90p-ish. So it came back down to the level at which I'd originally invested. And that's the way things go. That's the way companies go. They rise and they fall. The company made its money by selling billing software to utilities companies, to energy companies, and had a lot of clients in the UK. As you can imagine at the moment, that's not a great time. All of the smaller energy companies are popping out of business one after the other.
Well, unfortunately, my supplier as well, who I've been with 5 years.
Yeah. Timing is everything. And, you know, you'll always look at things and think, oh, you know, if only I'd stayed in. But if you'd stayed in and it started falling, you think, no, it'll come back. And then sometimes it just doesn't.
Now, timing is definitely crucially important. It's either the product's too early or it was too late or it was just the right time and you make a lot of money 18 months later. I want to talk about another one, though. So Wisgo, which was a pay-by-the-hour car hire business. Talk us through that story, because it's quite an interesting one.
Yes, fairly early on, I was approached by an old university friend who was working at a company which did pay-by-the-hour cars. And this was 2008. It was the spring of 2008. And he originally introduced me to the founder with the idea that I would invest in the company. And I looked at it and realized that it was likely to go bust fairly quickly. And I said, I'm sorry, but I can't invest in it because chances are that this is going to go bust. Anyway, lo and behold, a couple of months later, he approached me and said, look, it's going to go into administration. Are you interested in getting involved? And I'd never bought a business out of administration before. They have the opportunity, as opposed to being invited to invest at a pre-money valuation of about 3 million in a business that had debts of about 1 million. Here was an opportunity to buy the entire company for £50,000. And you think, aha, you know, I've got a very successful business. Everything that I touch turns to gold. Therefore, I will invest in this and I will show them how it's done. And I'm a great believer in the importance of luck. And sometimes you have good luck and sometimes you have bad luck. And the bad luck I had here was that I bought it in the first week of August 2008. And in the third week of August 2008, the global financial crisis hit. And the growth in that business depends entirely on the ability to be able to get leasing to expand your fleet. Leasing completely dried up. So that was a difficult business. And we kept it going and we tidied it up and eventually got it to a point where we sold it as a going concern. But I think I put about £1 million into it and I sold it as a going concern a year later for £1. And I kept the check to remind me that, in fact, not everything that I touch turns to gold at all. Some of it turns to mud. It was an interesting lesson. I think part of that was just bad timing, very bad timing. It was a great idea, but it was a little bit early. And in fact, that company is still going. It was bought by City Car Club and City Car Club then eventually sold out to Enterprise Cars. So Wisgo and the businesses and the people are still carrying on. But only now, years later, you know, 10, 12 years later, is it probably in a position where it's making money. And so that, again, comes back to that idea of, yes, people wanted it. They weren't necessarily prepared to pay the right price for it. And the other thing is, my last rule, is it easy to make money? No, actually, it's incredibly difficult to make money because you need an enormous amount of capital tied up in bits of tin on the street and very capital intensive. It also taught me, by the way, there's a very important lesson that I learned out of buying a business from administration is get rid of the founder straight away. Because in this case, the founder is a very bright girl, but she couldn't let go of the fact that she had lost her business. Her business had gone. Her business had died. And we were creating an opportunity for her to carry on a job. We were proposing about 20% of the equity if she got it right. But she didn't think that was enough. And I realized, of course, that she saw the administration merely as a refinancing of her own business rather than the funeral of her previous business and the rebirth and the birth of a new one. And the one thing that we didn't quite agree in all of the discussions about the administration was the percentage of share options that she would get for running it. We agreed the salary and everything else, but we just couldn't come to terms. So in the end, I had to get rid of her fairly early on. And that dragged us into the mire. But what it taught me is that a founder of a business that's gone into administration will only ever be able to see what they've lost, not what they stand to gain.
Yeah, and if they can't see that, then they're not willing to learn from the lessons.
Yeah, I mean, we would have been able to find an MD for the money that we were paying her. We would have been able to find a new MD. And in fact, what I'd suggest from the beginning was that, okay, this isn't working, so why don't I just pay you whatever an unfair dismissal maximum would be, which is about £66,000, and then you just move on straight away. But it's very hard to fire a CEO of a company and follow the normal procedure of it. You know, you basically have to just take them out and give them the bad news and not allow them back in the office. But then that is naturally an unfair dismissal because you haven't followed the right procedure. Anyway, so that it taught me a lot of lessons about buying businesses out of administration. It's not as easy as it looks.
No, I can only imagine. I haven't done it. I don't know if I ever will, but I'm writing notes down on this in case I ever do. So thank you for that. Two more just to come at you. So these were both investment opportunities that you sourced through Dragon's Den.
Oh, yeah.
You spent a year on the Dragon's Den. If you could give us a quick summary of what that experience was like.
It was a great experience, actually. The Dragon's Den is, I suppose, about the most realistic business program you can have while still being entertaining. They are real businesses that people have been working on for sometimes a year, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes 10 years. And it's real money that we're putting in. And we do end up having to look after them afterwards. So it's pretty real. And it's great fun doing it because it isn't any different, really, to people knocking on my door and asking me for money. It's just that there are some cameras there as well. One difference is that we don't get to see anything before the person comes into the den. And the reason for that is that they want us to be asking the same questions that the audience is. And if we've been given plenty of briefing beforehand, we would launch straight into a more complex set of questions. But it was great fun to make it. But the businesses that go on that have to be businesses that can be understood by the audience. So there's nothing complex and no complex B2B software solutions in there. It's generally speaking, consumer-facing stuff. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was great fun making it.
Yeah, we actually had a portfolio company called Wild AI that is on the show. It's a data play for women's fitness. It was quite an interesting experience having that one stand out versus much more commercial focused products. She was looking at kind of an 8 million pre-money valuation. The thing that had pitched before was looking at 300,000 pre-money valuation. Very different concept. And I think you're absolutely right. The business didn't necessarily resonate with the wider audience. And they decided to turn down the offer on the table, which was at a much lower valuation than that we're looking for. And
it works best with consumer products and products that can be understood by the mass audience. And in fact, when they're talking, they shouldn't really be aiming their pitch at the four people in front of them. They should be aiming their pitch at the 4 million people watching it, because if nothing else, it drives an enormous amount, can drive an enormous amount of business to your company.
So it's a great marketing tool.
It was a great experience. I was about 21 days of filming in each season, and I did two seasons of it. And we did about 7 or 8 pitches a day. And the pitches often last for about an hour, and they then shrink it down to the interesting bits.
Yeah, very cool. Well, there was two companies on there that I wanted to highlight real quick. So Double, which is a dating app. Talk us through that one.
Yeah, the concept behind Double Dating was quite clever in that the problem with online dating is that you end up with a girl or a boy meeting at a place and they have to size each other up and work out whether or not anything's going to happen. And that's quite a blunt and brutal process. And with Double, the idea is that you team up with a wingman and the girls would team up with a wing girl, and you pick a pair of girls, a pair of boys will pick a pair of girls to go for a drink with. And if two of them happen to like each other, then sparks will fly. But if not, there's no need for anyone to say at the end of this is going to go no further, or this doesn't work for me, or it's not me, it's you. And it also means that you've got someone to banter with with the awkwardness of meeting a person for the first time. It led to a better quality of first meeting. It was really, really popular. It was a freemium model. Amazingly, we managed to have about 30,000 customers in New York who were using it quite keenly, even though we'd never even been to New York. So I put some money into it, and it was all very good. People were using it. The problem was nobody really wanted to pay for it. And it was a lesson I learned there that yes, the first thing is, do people want it? Second thing is, people have got to be prepared to pay for it. And there has to be some underlying profitability. And it's a common problem that I see with apps, that the mindset is that apps should be free to start off with. And too many people are willing to offer things for free because they think, I'll worry about how to monetize it later. What that means is that a huge amount of investment goes into developing really good products, and it's given away too cheaply. So I'm very, very wary now. I've invested in a couple of apps, and I'm very, very wary of investing in them unless there's a clear route to income and revenue.
I wanted to ask you a few things that are slightly more personal.
Hmm.
Investing in startups is obviously incredibly risky. You know, most startups end up failing. You've had some successes and you've had some failures, and you've been on a roller coaster also as an entrepreneur. What is it that keeps you coming back and getting involved with startups?
I thoroughly enjoy the world of startups. I go back to my earlier point that it is a little bit like gambling, in that when you've done it a few times, you start to gain more experience and you think, aha, I've learned so much from that. I won't make the same mistake again. So next time when I see that, I'll be better informed and so on. And it's not a game of complete chance. There is a certain skill to it. And there's a rigor in the due diligence that you need to do in advance. And that's fun. It's a lot more fun than buying shares in Centrica and waiting for them to rise 2 or 3% a year. I keep it in proportion. I have a pot of money which I put into angel investing, and I have another larger pot of money that is with a portfolio that is all very sensibly managed. I would never put myself in a position where it makes a really big, significant material difference if it goes wrong. I have occasionally over-invested in a couple of companies and felt reasonably exposed. But it's great fun. I also enjoy working with entrepreneurs. I enjoy being useful. I think we all enjoy, have an innate desire to be useful. And if people think that your skill set is useful, very happy to give my time.
Definitely. I think there's quite a few people who invest in our fund who, in a way, live vicariously through their portfolio.
Yeah.
They work in the city, or they work in something and they have a very nice life that they don't want to risk giving up going down the entrepreneurship path themselves. But by investing in a startup or a fund, they kind of get that sense of the excitement and changing the world in many ways. So definitely hear you on that one. So Nick, you and I had a chat before the show a little bit about EIS, and you had some thoughts on EIS that I think are quite valuable and worth sharing.
Yeah, I think EIS has been an incredibly valuable scheme for Britain because it's encouraged a lot of people like me to recycle their money, thinking, well, hey, I can offset my income against this. That makes it much, much easier to make these investments than you would do otherwise. Latterly, what I have realized is, to some extent, the value of the tax relief is often baked into the valuation. And so the beneficiary of that tax break is more often than not the founder who is able to get a better valuation for a business than they would have had otherwise. I used to say, I'll only do EIS investments. I've got to limit myself to something, I'll only do EIS. Now what I've realized is that when something isn't EIS, it's generally considerably more reasonably priced, and that's factored in. That is something to bear in mind.
Do you think that, I mean, if I'm looking at the different factors that are impacting valuations, because the valuations right now are
insane,
super high at certain stages, it's ridiculous. But in, say, 2012, 2013, 14, you had crowdfunding, and crowdfunding allowed a much wider audience of people to come in and invest in things. But we saw kind of a step up in valuations because of that. Now we're seeing a step up in valuations because there's a flood of later stage capital coming from huge firms. Yeah, with crowdfunding, you get a lot of people taking advantage of EIS for the first time. Has that factored into the valuation increase at all?
I think in crowdfunding, there's an awful lot of people following and not many people doing the research. And one of the reasons I would never agree to be a cornerstone investor in a crowdfunding raise is because I don't want anybody to ever say, oh, but Nick, I only invested because I thought you'd done the homework. I don't want to be the one that is saying, I think this business is worth this price and therefore you should follow me. And that's what happens if you put yourself in as the cornerstone investor. Somebody wants to assume that somebody else has done the homework on it. And I suspect when we come to look at the returns of all the crowdfunding investment in 5 years' time, I'd be surprised if the returns are particularly good.
We've got some numbers on market-wide for crowdfunding, and it's not beating the market, if you will. So yeah, if you had invested into public markets, you would have got a better return overall versus, say, if there was an ETF of the crowdfunding investments. There are obviously a couple that are doing really well. You look at, say, Revolut, and Monzo is quite up there.
Were they
ever? Revolut did, I want to say, two rounds of crowdfunding through Cedars. You know, the first valuation that people went in at on the crowdfunding was quite high. I think it was 80 million or 100 million. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, you know, now they've just been valued at something like 5 billion. So anybody who's able to get out at that stage, you're thinking, wow, that's pretty good return. But if you look at Cedars' overall return as a platform, even with that huge uplift from Revolut, they're still underperforming like the S&P 500. And so it's good if you got into it, but for most people who didn't, invested in other things, they're, you know, sitting on a loss.
Yeah, and you probably find that Revolut might well be responsible for most of the return of the entire thing. And if you weren't in Revolut, then probably would have lost out. There'll be the odd star performer, but I think it's a great way of, if you raised £1 million between a bunch of investors and you want to increase that, it's a great way of going to the market and, say, doubling that by going to crowdfunding. But my experience is that people don't really look at the numbers. I looked at one deck where it said, we expect to be making £1 million a year in 4 years' time if all goes well. And we expect to be valued at 10 times earnings. And we put a pre-money valuation of £10 million on the business. So what you're saying is that if everything goes according to plan, I'll get no return on my money whatsoever for the next 4 years. Why would I do that? And yet they oversubscribed.
Yeah. So
clearly people didn't. All these decks are beautifully produced and with lots of lovely pictures and graphics, and they're lovely. But people just look at the pictures and they're not looking at the numbers.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, obviously we used to be involved in crowdfunding, but we still source the deals from angels and VCs. So there was a cornerstone of sorts, and people either jump in because they see something shiny, or they jump in, like you said earlier, because they see a name that they recognize investing. And it's like, actually, no, you should be spending 10 to 20 hours doing your own research on this deal, because that's roughly how much the angels are putting in. You shouldn't just take the word for it, because even the angels are going to get it wrong. You know, the angels will get 1 in 10 and that'll cover more than their portfolio, but the other 9, probably not going to get a good return on them.
I think one of the really interesting ones will be BrewDog, because people are beginning to wake up to the nature of the deal that was done with TSG, where TSG came in and they got a liquidation preference with an 18% coupon. But an 18% coupon over 7 years really adds up.
Yeah, it's quite steep.
Well, I think they're 213 million that they put in. I mean, I think of that 213 million, half of that was paid directly to the founders to buy secondary shares, which they magically converted into C shares with a preference on them.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
That is bizarre. And they said at the time, they said to everyone, oh, it's marvelous, because they've come in and they've valued us at 1 billion. But now it's 5 years down the road. The business would need to sell for 600 million in order just to cover before any ordinary shareholders got anything. And that's a business that turns over 200 million and doesn't really make much money at the moment.
Something doesn't add up there.
And after that, they went on, they raised even, I mean, even this year, they went on and raised money at a valuation of a billion. But then again, some people just think, hey, I like being a part of BrewDog, and I've got £100 of the shares, and if it goes wrong, blah, you know, no big deal.
And I get to carry a card around that says I'm an equity punk and get a discount whenever I buy drinks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And to be honest, you know, if you're doing it for that, fine. But if you're doing it hoping for a strong financial return, then go through the numbers properly.
Yes, I mean, but there's a reason why the government invented lots of rules about trading shares, and how there are also very, very strict rules about it. And that's because they don't want people turning around afterwards and saying, hang on, how was I allowed to do this? Surely someone should have told me that this was unsafe. So I wouldn't be surprised to see crowdfunding being a bit more regulated.
I'm wondering if you could go back in time and speak to yourself when you were just starting out angel investing. If there was one bit of advice you would give yourself then, what would it be?
I think that one really important thing is to know when to give up on a business, because you can keep throwing good money after bad in the hope that things will change. But you have to look very, very hard at the numbers and make a judgment call. It's sometimes easier to write the check, the next check, rather than bite the bullet, do the analysis and work out that it isn't going to work. And then you can get in too deep. I've had a couple of investments where I've carried on investing when I probably should have stopped.
Keeping on the gambling theme, do you feel that like you were pot committed to those? Like, oh, I've got to see this out because I'm just in too far already.
I try hard to look at every investment I make as a new investment. And then I said to myself, actually, if someone approached me with this business idea, knowing what I know now about this business, I wouldn't touch it. So why should I put any more money in? And that's the discipline you have to have. You have to look at every new investment as if you hadn't previously been involved.
No, I think that's spot on with that. Definitely. It's not, oh, I've already got money in it. It's, if I was approaching this fresh at this stage, would I have said yes or no?
Yeah. I also learned another very important lesson on that point, actually, that we had a bit of, we had one company where there was a bit of a struggle going on and they needed to raise more money. And I said, I'll put it in, but I'll put it in as a preference share with a liquidation preference, because I didn't want to have an argument about how the fact that how the company was actually probably worth very little. But at least I wanted to know that I would get my investment back if things went wrong. And I learned a really, really important lesson about preference shares, which is preference shares are worth absolutely nothing if you don't control the vote. Because when it comes down to it, if you've put £1 million of the preference shares into a business and somebody offers 1.1 million for it, you could get all of your money back. But what it means is the ordinary equity holders stand to get a mere £100,000 back for the whole of their lot. So their view is, well, why should we agree to a sale? What's in it for us?
True.
And then it becomes a negotiation. So if ever I was in that situation again, I would always make sure that with those preference shares that I got an accelerated vote that would enable me to effectively to put the business into a sale if necessary.
Very smart.
In that particular case, I was involved in the business and I managed to bring the business to a point where somebody had offered us, I think I was owed £1.5 million in pref shares, and I got someone to offer £5 million for the business. The other shareholders thought it wasn't enough and they turned it down, and then it subsequently went under.
No, that's very good insight. All right, a bit of a leap forward with this one. So 10 to 20 years down the line, you take a look back on all that you've done with creating your own startup, investing in startups, all of that. What do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I look at Moonpig, for example, and I haven't been involved in Moonpig for a long time, but I take a great deal of pride in seeing people use it, seeing people talk about it, and seeing it written about. And with a lot of businesses, it's but you have a child, and it's like watching a child go off to university. You're connected to them in some form or another, but they're no longer your responsibility. I mean, I most important, I want to look back and make sure that I've enjoyed my time doing it. Too many people focus on a business in the sense of they start a business in order to exit, and they forget that there's a very, very enjoyable process along the way where you put together a team of people that you enjoy working with, and you have fun, and you have a few difficult moments and a few fun moments and some excitement. And that's the journey. And the journey is really good fun. Rather than a legacy, I would look back and think, did I waste my time? Did I make the most of that time? I've been involved in some businesses that have been great fun. I've worked with some really clever people that I've enjoyed working with. And I've helped create businesses that otherwise wouldn't have existed. I think the difference between being a founder and an investor is as a founder, I look at it and think, if it wasn't for me, Moonpig would never exist. I'm sure somebody else would have come up with something similar, for sure, but it wouldn't be Moonpig. And as an investor, you have the satisfaction of looking at things and thinking, well, if I hadn't put more money in, they might well have died and stopped. And that's the legacy that I have as the investor, having been an essential part in making it happen or keeping it going.
I think that answer sums up what I would think of as the culture of Moonpig from the outside. Just, it was clearly a stressful time creating the company with ups and downs, but you look back on it just on the fun side of it. And you mentioned it earlier as well, you know, surrounding yourself with good people, you know, people that you want to be around, people that don't make it like work. They make it more enjoyable and you're getting things done. So I definitely think that I would love to have you and my team or be a part of your team should you ever set something up.
When I look back, there's one big difference of my entrepreneurial career compared to my employed career is that for the last 25 years, I've got to 5 o'clock and wished it was still 2 o'clock in the afternoon. What I never want to do is to get to 2 o'clock and wish it was 5 o'clock. I had a very, very dull job when I was at university in the holidays as some sort of clerk transferring license details from one piece of paper to another. And I would get to 10 o'clock and couldn't believe that it wasn't 5 o'clock already. It was so painfully boring. So not being bored and having fun doing what you're doing is perhaps the greatest reward you can get from any of this.
I love that. Absolutely love that. Last one then, you know, you've had this great journey. What's next for Nick Jenkins?
I've done 28 angel investments and probably spread myself fairly widely because I was quite curious about different business models. What I would like to do now is to focus much more on the sustainable energy side. That's an area I'm particularly interested in. What I've realized also is that it's slightly more satisfying being involved in a business when you really understand the core subject matter. And for that, you do need to specialize quite a bit.
Nick, thank you ever so much. It's been an absolute joy. And you know, there's been some incredible insights that have come out of this conversation. I do hope that maybe in 12 months, we can revisit the conversation and maybe talk specifically about sustainable energy, green tech and such, if you'd like that. But for now, I'm going to say thank you one last time and have a great rest of your week.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode of Angel Insights. And for more news about Syndicate Room, follow us on Twitter at Syndicate Room or myself at Tom Britton. And we do, as always, hope you'll join us for the next episode of Angel Insights in a few weeks' time. Until then, bye.